Case number 20-3598 and 20-3600, Max Rack Incorporated versus Core Health and Fitness LLC et al. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Little, you're going first?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Robert Collins Little, LITTLE, on behalf of the appellants and the cross appellees, Core Health and Fitness, and greetings to my friend on the other side. Your Honors, this court has consistently resisted and corrected bestowing an undeserved windfall on plaintiffs in trademark infringement cases. And after this 3.5-day jury trial, actively presided over by Judge Marbley, a manifest injustice did occur. How so? One, there was a conceded lack of proof of actual confusion. Two, there was an abject failure of proof of likelihood of confusion. And three, there was a misplaced focus on an unenforceable agreement to pay royalties on expired patents in perpetuity. How do we know it was unsupported by the evidence, Your Honors? There's one single document in the record that upon which this entire trademark infringement case hinges, and that's Exhibit 112. Exhibit 112, which appears in the appendix at page 14, is a Google search. And in that Google search, there is the words Max Rack that appear on the website for Star Trek. But of course they do. These commercial fitness products were warrantied by Star Trek for a period of no less than one decade. So there would actually be a problem if there were not some appearance of Max Rack in association with Star Trek, because Star Trek had an ongoing legal obligation to service and support this equipment.
Would you agree that Max Rack has two distinct theories? It seems to me they're distinct. The first theory is the use of Max Rack on the website or in the owner's manual caused a likelihood of confusion about the new Freedom Rack and whether it was associated with the Max Rack, and that's what that evidence went to. But they also, at least in their appellate brief — I know the district court didn't reach this in its judgment as a matter of law order — but in their appellate brief, they suggest that Freedom Rack or Core Strength continued to manufacture Max Racks and sell those illicit Max Racks after the expiration date. And if they violated the contract by selling illicit Max Racks, that would almost automatically create a likelihood of confusion in my mind, because they're selling Max Racks that they have no right to sell. And so why wasn't there enough evidence to suggest at least that second theory? I know the district court didn't focus on it, but that's another theory that they present in their red brief.
Yes, Your Honor, correct. And the reason that the district court didn't focus on it was because it was clear that the Max Racks that are discussed as sold during the period in the appellate brief, those were the Max Racks that were sold during the sell-off period. And under the contract, there was an absolute right for Core Health to continue to sell off its existing —
it would only be the existing.
The existing inventory, yes, Your Honor.
Their argument is that you continue to manufacture them after November 21st, and for instance, citing the email showing that there might have been a transition happening in December, which is almost a month later. So those late manufactured — I know they could continue manufacturing ones that where they started on November 21st, but any that started after November 21st, those would be in violation of the contract. And I think that was the theory that I saw.
One of the things we have to remember, Your Honor, is that the Max Rack device and the Freedom Rack device are absolutely identical. There is no difference between these two things, because upon expiration of the patent, the Max Rack the unique horizontal movement of the MaxRack was in the public domain. Anyone could manufacture a device identical.
Legally different, are they not? In that the word MaxRack couldn't be applied to the ones that were started to be made after the particular date.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
The question of my colleague is, isn't there evidence that some of them were started to be made after that date?
There is no evidence that a MaxRack, well, let me put it this way, Your Honors. There's abundant evidence that a device that was formerly known as the MaxRack and subsequently called the Freedom Rack was manufactured after November of 2015 and on to date. There's abundant evidence of that. Was there evidence that a MaxRack or a Freedom Rack, well, I'll put it this way, I'm sorry, sir?
Just call it a rack.
A rack, yes, Your Honor. That one of these racks were manufactured and that a label that said MaxRack was placed over a label that said Freedom Rack or vice versa. There is no evidence of that in the record.
Is there evidence that my understanding of your question, if correct me if I'm wrong, is there evidence of one of these racks starting to be made after the relevant date and having had MaxRack put on it?
Yes, Your Honor, there's no...
That's the issue, right? If so, then that's a violation. They can't start to make a new one and put the MaxRack label on it.
But I think, Your Honors, the question is whether or not someone purchased... Their purchase of a Freedom Rack was attributable to the mark of a MaxRack. And I don't believe there was any evidence of that, and we don't see that in Judge Marbley's order on the motion for judgment as a matter of law, because...
What about the email that Judge Murphy refers to?
Yeah, the email...
Provide evidence for the question that I tried to articulate?
Well, Your Honor, my understanding when I read the email is that the email sets the date in which the part number 8505 was changed to 8507. That's my recollection of the email. Did that create sales of Freedom Racks?
Well, as you say, Freedom Racks are the same as Max Racks. The question is, did that promote sale? Were those that were started to be made after that date ever get the words Max Rack attached to them in the process of publicizing them and delivering them and selling them? That would be the question, right? Your Honor,
I don't believe there was evidence to that.
So the email I'm talking about is from Kevin Corvallis. It's November 3rd.
Yes, Your Honor.
It says the last serial number produced, and then I think it has the MaxRack number 1085, is December 2015. Doesn't that suggest that there were some MaxRacks that were produced in December of 2015? Or no? I mean, this is what a reasonable jury could find. And
true, but we have to remember that CoreHealth paid royalties on not just the... Every Freedom Rack that was sold, whether it was previously labeled a MaxRack or was subsequently labeled a Freedom Rack, every one that was sold after expiration of the patents, CoreHealth paid MaxRack a royalty on those. So it received exactly what it had bargained for under the contract, Your Honors. And when we get back to the universe of confusion, I really do think that the evidence here focused on the Exhibit 112, the Google search, which Judge Marbley focused on. And also, I have to say, it is not clear. The record is confused here because we do have the questions from the jury that they are not focused on the use of the MaxRack mark. They're focused on the unenforceable addendum, the agreement that Core Health pay MaxRack royalties in perpetuity, which we know is an agreement that's against public policy and is unenforceable. That's where the confusion came, Your Honors, in the...
Can I ask you about the owner's manual, too?
Yes, Your Honor.
I was unclear. When did you discover the... unpack the MaxRack in the owner's manual, like, at trial?
During the deposition, Your Honor, of Aaron O'Brien.
So the way I read the trial testimony, it's the... Moritz, I guess, it was his testimony.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he suggested that the morning of trial, he went to the website and saw unpack the MaxRack in the owner's manual still. Is that correct? Is that when you discovered it, or did you discover it earlier and you still hadn't fixed it by trial? I was just curious if you could clarify.
It was definitely fixed by trial, because there's a subsequent owner's manual for Nautilus that it appears in the record. So it was fixed by trial. Was this orphan instantiation of MaxRack, does it appear in the owner's manual? Yes. Is the owner's manual a post-sale document? It is, Your Honor. I see that I've...
You may complete your answer.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. So Exhibit 131, to the extent that contained this orphan reference, amongst 16 references to the Freedom Rack, there's one reference to the MaxRack. We would, particularly given the context in which it arises in a post-sale non-marketing document, we would respectfully submit, Your Honors, that that could not be an infringement. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Little, Mr. Loomis. I'm Matthew Schoenauer. I'm here representing Plaintiff MaxRack and Appellee and Cross Appellant. Core Health would have you believe that this is a case about a windfall that was awarded to MaxRack as the result of a failed and ended licensing agreement. When in fact, I think that the totality of the evidence shows that it really was a wholesale goodwill appropriation by a licensee of a mark owned by a licensor. When we look at trademark infringement cases and unfair competition cases, what it always boils down to is, was there use of a trademark in a manner that is likely to confuse the consumers? And we're really, in large part, protecting consumers from being confused as to the source of the product. Here we have conceded use. Much of the use discussed at trial fell under a termination clause. So Core Health took the position that, yes, we used the mark MaxRack after the termination of the license. That was the authorization for us to use the mark. But what the question is whether that conceded use was lawful, and we say that it wasn't.
I agree with my view that there's almost two theories here. One was the use of MaxRack to sell Freedom Racks, and the other one was the illicit continuation of manufacturing Max Racks in violation of the agreement. And those two things strike me as distinct.
Thank you, Judge. I think that in a way they are distinct, but in a way they're also very related, because when you have a holdover licensee situation, what happens is they're able to use their previously authorized use of the mark, their status as an authorized user, to then basically take over the minds of the consumers and enforce the new brand on them.
I don't think that is necessarily wrong. There's a section of McCarthy on trademarks, I think it is, that talks about comparative advertising, and trademarks aren't patents. So you're allowed to take the functionality. You're allowed to have the same machine once the patent expires. And I do think that you're allowed. I think that section suggests is actually promotes competition to say this is essentially the MaxRack,
right?
Because it tells consumers that it's the same exact product. So I don't know, like, you know, the incidences where they say formerly known as the MaxRack, that strikes me as not problematic, as long as it's accurate, of course. So why if that's true, then why aren't these other uses of MaxRack just like that?
I think that in a vacuum, you're certainly correct that when you have a licensee that no longer licenses your mark, they certainly are allowed to comparatively advertise their mark and advertise their new brand. That's not a problem. I think where you run into a problem is where they intentionally conflate the two, and I think that there was plenty of evidence of that happening due to their holdover status. For example, we have unequivocal testimony from their employees stating that we sold units after the expiration of the license labeled as MaxRack, so the customer bought a MaxRack and they received a Freedom Rack. And to me, that's cut and dry passing off.
If it's the exact same item, I'm not sure I understand, unless they're referring to one that was produced afterwards. When you say they sold a Freedom Rack and said it was a MaxRack, were the particular items produced after the time? And if not, then they were allowed to sell them off under the agreement, right?
Well,
is that right?
They did have a cell phone.
I'm tracking Judge Murphy's distinction closely in my mind, and I'm not seeing how you're getting me off of that, I guess.
So the passing off problem in my mind is that we don't know specifically when they stopped.
Judge Murphy as distinguishing that issue from the other issue of they were saying confusing things about the new ones. The new ones had a booklet which referred to MaxRack in the procedure manual, right? Or there's what, you know, I looked at the exhibit, minuscule place where, with my bad eyesight, I couldn't see that it said anything. It looked like a scratch. But, you know, yeah, if you get the magnifying glass out, it says MaxRack. That those two things together amounted to passing off, that just seemed, not too compelling.
I see the distinction, and I think that
The second one, the one that we were carving out about after-made products, that I understand. But the former one, I'm not seeing where you have much going. What do we do, in other words, if we reject the one but accept the possibility that there's evidence of the other?
I think that by bifurcating them, like, in a very direct manner, you kind of lose the problem with being a holdover licensee, because the problem with trademark law in general is that we want to show evidence that there has been damage, because it's very difficult to go out and march exactly what happened, you know, several years down the road in you know, at the time when this happened. And I think also at the end of a license, you can have appropriate comparative advertising, and you can have something that usurps the owner's goodwill when people think that, hey, you know us as selling the MaxRack, us being Core Health, we renamed our product, when that's not what happened. So people don't look for a MaxRack anymore because they think it's a Freedom Rack now, because there was no alternative in the market when they were a holdover licensee during that period. So I think that
I agree with you that the it goes to damages, but what I'm like, so the district court, for instance, when thinking about profits, the statute, section 117, says that you have the burden approving defendant sales, and then the burden flips. So I take it you're not arguing that your only task is to prove their ultimate gross revenue on all products, even those totally unrelated. And so we kind of have to know what the theory of liability is in order to determine what the appropriate sales are.
Sure.
And it seems to me that under the two theories, the sales would be different. So I suppose you could say that all Freedom Racks would be tainted under the first theory because you're passing a MaxRack off as a Freedom Rack, and I think that's what the district court accepted when finding the $250,000 in profits was fine. But under the alternative theory, wouldn't it just be, if it was really that they continue to manufacture racks known that had MaxRack on the label in violation of the agreement, wouldn't it be more limited in terms of the sales to just those specific pieces of equipment? Do you see the point I'm making?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. I think that the measure of profits could appropriately be limited in time to, at some point, they sell a Freedom Rack free and clear of the Max Rack. I think the jury's job factually was to determine how much their unauthorized use benefited them in selling the Freedom Rack. And I think that they did that in giving a reasonable amount of profits. They didn't award all Freedom Rack profits. It was just a portion, a temporal portion of those profits.
So can I ask you a quick question to that? You may want to circle back to some of the other issues you've been discussing, but I'd like to ask about the attorney's fees. And what is it on the record in this case that would make this an exceptional or extraordinary case that would justify an award of attorney's fees? I mean, the cases you see where attorney's fees have been awarded, there have been cease and desist orders that have been issued and ignored. I mean, more, I guess what you call egregious conduct by the violator. This seemed to be a pretty close case. Just wondering what supports this attorney fee award.
Thank you. So I think primarily the intentionality is kind of driving the attorney fee award in this case. I think the jury was convinced that this unlawful use in the licensee holdover was done in a willful manner. There was a lot of testimony about essentially the Core Health deciding we're going to end our relationship with you and then not doing anything until many months after the end of the license agreement. And I think that it was clear at trial that that intentional conduct was done to benefit Core Health at my client's expense. And I think that was clear at trial, and I think that was driving the attorney fee factor when we really weren't just in terms of trying to get this, settled out of court, just weren't close at all.
Wouldn't you distinguish, in my view, the exceptional case is one, which say it's a franchisee. We had a case involving Little Caesars where the main company told a franchisee, we don't like your restaurant, you need to stop it. And the franchisee went right along being a Little Caesars with all the same ingredients, all the same trademarks. Here, you would have to admit there was some amount of effort, right? I mean, you found a snippet in an email, you found a typo, and what they claim was a typo, you might suggest it was intentional, but in the owner's manual, there's not a whole bunch of evidence that they weren't at least attempting to accomplish the transition.
Well, we don't expect there to be a ton of evidence of intentionality and that they, were attempting to make pecuniary gain by doing what they did. I kind of go back to all of the totality of the circumstances presented at trial and all of Core Health employee testimony. I think that it was convincing that we had a power disparity between a licensor and a licensee that the licensor got taken advantage of, and it really damaged the market for the racks. I see I have a few minutes left. If you have no further questions on evidence, I'd like to touch base quickly on the requirement of actual confusion as a prerequisite to an award of compensatory damages. In vacating the jury award of $1 million in compensatory damages, Chief Judge Marbley cited to Balance Dynamics as the primary case in which that actual confusion requirement is mandated. Our brief and our position is that Balance Dynamics, while it does acknowledge that general rule of actual damages being required as a prerequisite, in fact sets the carve-out exception to that rule, and there are multiple cases that carve out those exceptions, and there is in fact a circuit split about whether or not actual confusion should be a concrete requirement in advance of actual damage awards. In light of the Romag decision of the Supreme Court in 2020, that case said to, you know, we need to look for these damages awards. We need to really kind of go back to the statute and see what is in there and what is actually mandated by that. And in a related context, they found that willfulness is not a prerequisite to certain kinds of awards under Section 1117 of the Lanham Act. And in a parallel reasoning, if you look at the statute, actual confusion is also not a requirement.
I don't think we've found it to be a requirement. I mean, your suggestion of balance, it was a balance dynamics, I forget the name, it had a carve-out for the remediation costs. So those are real costs, those are real damages to fix false advertising or something, and you don't have to show actual confusion to get to obtain those costs. But I don't think you've presented any evidence of those types of costs here. So it does seem to me that willfulness is unrelated to profits in a way that actual confusion, actually, the inverse, actual confusion might be related to damages, because that's how you prove, like, lost profits or lost revenue.
I could say that, I mean, that's a good point. However, I don't think that actual damages, actual confusion is required, because a lot of times you can't find evidence of that, and it can be difficult evidence to get before a jury as well.
Doesn't that just mean you haven't been damaged, or?
I don't think it means you haven't been damaged. I just think it means that you just didn't show actually confused people. But there are the Second Circuit, for example, has a variety of cases which I've discussed that allow inferences of actual confusion based on willful conduct. So, you know, we could go that route here if we need actual confusion. I think that there was a strong enough case for willfulness.
Set aside actual confusion. What is your main case for damages? Like, you're not producing any MaxRack, sure. So you haven't lost MaxRack revenue. What?
Thank you. The actual award, the actual damages award at trial of $1 million, it seems to be based on our testimony setting a floor for the total investment costs into the brand, which we think that the evidence before the jury showed that was basically eviscerated and appropriated by Core Health. So I think that that's the basis for the actual confusion award, the actual damages award. See, I'm out of time. Thank you.
No further questions.
Thank you, Your Honors. In terms of the total investment cost of the brand being the basis for the $1 million, that cannot legally be the basis for trademark infringement damages, because those costs are not associated with damages that occurred due to the unauthorized display of the MaxRack mark. And with respect to the second theory, Your Honor, Judge Murphy's the second theory, which has been identified as the second theory, is, I'll call it the passing off theory. The passing off theory is gutted by Justice Scalia's opinion in Daystar versus 20th Century Fox, which expressed the opinion of the court. And in Daystar, it pointed out that when there's a single origin, as there is here, the single origin of the product, there can't be this infringing activity. I do want to say that
you would admit you couldn't continue to market a product as the MaxRack.
We can only continue to service and support MaxRacks under the 10-year warranty. That's right.
Wouldn't it be a plain likelihood of confusion violation? Suppose you were just making MaxRacks today, and you don't own the trademark. Wouldn't there be a clear likelihood of confusion as to the source, and that for if you did engaged in that conduct?
Because the source was always Core Health, and because, as Your Honor pointed out, they never went into the market and they never competed, there wouldn't be a likelihood of confusion, but that would be an unauthorized use of that mark, Your Honor.
I was going to say, that would suggest you could just steal her mark.
No. That would be an unauthorized use of that mark. That is correct, Your Honor. But I would stress that the only issue is whether any Freedom Rack was sold based on an unauthorized display of the Max Rack trademark. And there's no evidence of that except Exhibit 112, which is, Senior Judge Rogers pointed out, this minuscule, these thumbnails, and is the definition of a mere scintilla of evidence. It doesn't rise to the level of trademark infringement evidence. And I see, Your Honor.
I wasn't going to say anything.
Can I just follow up on that? Is there any evidence, like if you actually clicked on the Google link and you went to the homepage, there's no evidence that there was any MaxRack statements on the specific homepage after you went to the link? It's just the snippet.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. There is no evidence of that.
How did it show up? If it's not on the website, it was in the metadata somehow, or?
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that's correct. They had cleansed the website in terms of marketing of all of the instantiations of MaxRack, but there was this leftover. That's how it showed up. Or, actually, it's unclear because it could have been connected to the support website. I don't think there was any evidence one way or another as to how this appeared. It was because it could have been connected to the support site as well.
It didn't. Like, the link looked like, if you followed it, you know, if you have the hash or whatever those marks are, it was on the sales page. It didn't look like it was on the warranty page. So that would suggest it wasn't extraneous mark as compared to the warranty idea.
Correct, but I do think that the important thing is to come back to whether or not there is a single MaxRack that was a Freedom Rack that was sold as a result of the unauthorized display of MaxRack. And, Your Honors, I would respectfully submit in this case there wasn't. And with respect to Judge Cole's question, this is not the exceptional case. The circuit defines the exceptional case as involving deliberate, willful, fraudulent. In that rubric of cases, this did not fall within that case. This is definitely the circumstance in which Rule 50 and Rule 59 were designed to protect. We would respectfully request that if the court does not find that we should be entitled to judgment as a matter of law, that at bare minimum it be remanded for a new trial. And unless there are any questions, I thank Your Honors for your attention, and I'd respectfully submit.
Yeah, I just have one quick question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you recall whether you requested that the district court vacate the profits award?
Yes, Your Honor, we did. Yes, Your Honor. That would be reflected in docket 113-1, which is the corrected motion for a new trial and motion for judgment as a matter of law. Your Honor will find it there, and I think it is addressed in docket 117, which is the district court's order on that.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel, we appreciate your arguments this morning. Thank you very much. The case will be submitted, and